Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing extraordinarily well. I am back from a little vacation.
You had a good time. You missed all the you missed the first couple episodes then of Hell's Kitchen.
I did.
It's really a shame.
I did. I went on a no TV and precious little good food vacation. A friend of mine from Ireland was buying a Harley Davidson in Montana.
So he didn't care that there was precious little good food.
No. Lawrence is quite an eater. But we picked up. He was buying a Harley Davidson in Montana, going to drive it back to New Jersey and ship it over to Ireland. And so I met him in Montana and also bought a Harley Davidson and rode it most of the way back.
Why did you buy him a Harley Davidson in Montana? I've been explaining it to people for the whole time you've been gone. I still don't completely understand it.
Because if I wanted to ride a motorcycle that I currently own to Montana, I'd have to drive it to Montana.
Aha.
So if I get to buy it, I'm already there.
And poof, you're in the Rockies.
And I'm there. So we were in Montana. We had some good food there.
Montana?
Yeah. We had elk.
Okay.
And, of course, wild salmon is in season.
Yes, time.
And so we had some good elk. We actually, Lawrence and I took the guy who sold us our Harley Davidsons out for dinner. I don't know why. It makes perfect sense when you consider it.
Because he hadn't made enough money on the sale.
No, he's really nice guy. And he told us all about Montana, and there were streams. And it's amazing out there.
You took him out to pump him for information.
No.
You're not fooling me.
But it's amazing.
He's the only guy in Montana you know.
I know a couple of them. But it's amazing out there how big everything is. The scale of the United States west of the Rockies is just incredible. Took a trip down, went through Yellowstone, mm-hmm. And then went through Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which is supposed to be a great food town. Sadly, we couldn't stay. We had to keep going.
Oh, that's too bad.
Eaton Pass, yeah. It looked like a great little town.
Well, you know, a lot of those towns that kind of erupted out of the ski towns mm-hmm. have developed this cuisine because, first of all, in that area of the world, you ski for 8 months a year because you have 85-degree weather or 100-degree weather in the valley sometimes
right.
and 30-degree weather on the mountaintop, and you're skiing. I went out to that Colorado area on a big ski trip with some friends, and we drove around at night, tons of snow every night. And 40, 50 degrees during the day, it was an awesome place to go ski.
I actually had to get back, but I got snowed out at the at Breckenridge and Vail. It was snowing on mm-hmm. the mountain, and, you know, motorcycles and snow, not really a smart
combination. Not a good mix. Not a good mix.
So I sort of had the bikes trucked over the mountain and picked them up on the other side to get to Denver. But I did go down to two women we've had on the show before, Blake Spaulding and Jen Castle from mm-hmm. Hell's Backbone Grill in Boulder, Utah. If you'd like to check out the show, it's a two-part show you can find on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, about a cookbook they wrote about their very amazing restaurant.
Great cookbook that with beautiful photography really shows off the area of the world from which they come.
And it's a beautiful area that they come from, and it's in the most isolated town in America. Mail was delivered there by mule train until 1949. And you take Highway 12 up a 10,000-foot mountain and then back down again to get to them, and then you got to do the same on the other side to get away. They grow a lot of their own food.
Did you have to get away?
No, I wish I could have stayed.
Did you do something?
No, I wish I could have stayed. There's a resort there you can stay overnight. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not the kind of place you pop in for dinner and then go home. But I spent a couple of days there with them and my friend Lawrence, who also grew up on a farm. And they have their own farm. They bought their own farmland now. They're growing a lot of their own produce. We went to Blake's house where she's raising the chickens that they get their eggs from in the morning.
That's great. That's great.
And, you know, it's funny. City boy over here, she says, Blake says, we're out in the chicken coop or in the little chicken yard. And she says, oh, Francis, will you fill this, like the chicken watering thing? I don't even know the name of it. We didn't have those in Jersey City when I was a kid. She says, will you fill this up? I'm like, oh, yeah, where's the hose? She's like, no hose. See that creek over there? Walk over there.
Dip it in.
But exactly. Yeah. But if you're wondering why, you know, how to make great food, It really starts in the field and at the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no antibiotics. There's no hormones. There, you know, it's there's the chicken named Sally. She's going to be dinner tomorrow night.
And the next thing we're going to be talking about in the this country, I think, is eggs. I think it's one of those items that is going to come to the forefront of high-quality eggs from chickens that are fed right, that are fresh, taste different than the eggs you buy in your supermarket. Taste different.
Well, one of the reasons I think that you're right is that no hormone. Organic milk is the largest single item in the organic marketplace mm-hmm. right now and fastest growing. There are actually shortages of it. And people are willing to pay for it because people don't like the idea of recombinant bovine growth hormone and antibiotics in the cows that eventually give you milk. And I believe that in non-ultra-pasteurized organic milk, you can taste a difference.
Oh, there's no question about it.
It just tastes better.
There's no question about it. In my mind, there's no question.
I agree.
About
and also, I buy my milk now from Ronniebrook Farms, which mm-hmm. you can find in some places. It's non-homogenized, so mm-hmm. it separates, and they have a cream-lined milk that separates. And you can simply taste the difference.
No. I was at Union Square just last Wednesday, Union Square Market, and they sell Ronniebrook Farms there. They also, I don't know if you've been there recently, their chocolate milk, you could take their chocolate milk, it is so good, and just spin it right into ice cream.
Yeah,
just exactly the way it is, you could turn it into chocolate ice cream. It's unbelievable. They have yogurt, like smoothies there.
Yeah, I have them for breakfast every day.
They're unbelievable.
Well, the thing about Ronniebrook Farms dairies is they are organic, they're hormone-free, but they also don't homogenize, which is hard to find these mm-hmm. days. And the milk will separate into the cream. Now, one of the things you want to realize about whole milk, when you buy whole milk in the supermarket, it's not necessarily whole milk.
Right.
They can take off a certain amount of the fat. There's a minimum level of fat of cream they have to leave in to be called whole milk.
Even some of the organics take some of the cream off.
Right. So your whole milk isn't really whole.
It's almost never whole milk.
Ronniebrook Farms whole milk is whole milk. And if you want skim milk and you want cream, you can make it. Just don't shake it. But the reason that you're absolutely right, Mark, that the next area
eggs. I'm sure of it. I'm sure that the next thing that great chefs are going to be talking about are the eggs that they got.
I mean, you see it already on menus. You see it on our menu when we will put like a hen's egg on the menu. We've done it on a couple of recent wine dinner menus. But one of the things that's so gratifying about that is the consumer looks, and we have some sophisticated diners who dine in our restaurant, and when we put our hen's egg on the menu, they'll say, "Oh my God, look at the color of that yolk." And you're like, you can see from across the room that an egg raised in a non-battery caged hen without antibiotics, without hormones, and from some older breeds of chickens makes you a very yellow yolk and a very flavorful egg.
It's a much more flavorful egg. The texture is different. It looks different. It cooks differently. It's amazing the differences, and I'm going to encourage every listener to this show to go out and find some fresh eggs somewhere from organically vegetarian chickens.
Saddam Farms, right around here in New Brunswick area. Hey, I have one shot on one city I went through. I hear that there are some good restaurants in Salt Lake City. I didn't have the time to seek them out, but I did go to a couple of terrible ones. And all I have to say about Salt Lake City, Utah is, with all the salt in that great Salt Lake, you'd think they could use some on the food. You know what I mean? You think they could
blend. I get the feeling maybe tomorrow or the next day's show is going to start with some bad restaurant stories from Francis Shaw.
Bland is not the word, and I'm Irish, okay? but evidently, Salt Lake City, they out-Irish the Irish. We have coming up in the next segment of the show, Trevor Corson. You've heard him before on our show from his book, when he came to discuss his book, The Secret Life of Lobsters. He has a new book out. It's a novel called The Zen of Fish, and we're going to be talking about sushi with Trevor Corson in just a moment. Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Trevor Corson. He was on the show one time before to talk about his wonderful book, The Secret Life of Lobsters. And today he's here to talk about his novel, The Zen of Fish, the story of sushi from samurai to supermarket.
Trevor Corson, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back with you guys.
Now, Trevor, this really isn't the story of samurai of sushi from samurai to supermarket. It's a novel.
Well, I'll correct you on that. It's nonfiction.
Okay.
So Everything in the book is true. I'm a journalist, and I went to extraordinary lengths in writing this book to make sure that I documented everything I wrote, all the action, all the dialogue. I hung out with the people I wrote about. Sorry, if you hear some noise in the background.
Are you a fireman part-time as well? It sounds like there's you need to go to a fire.
I don't know. They may have heard I had a big stash of sushi up here. And the police up to investigate, the sushi police. Hopefully nothing terrible will happen. But
it's a story. It follows a young woman.
Basically what I try to do with my writing is I try to tell a story, always true story, and then I try to weave information into the story so that you kind of learn without realizing it. And that's what I did with The Secret Life of Lobsters, and that's what I've done with this book, too. So, yeah, as you mentioned, it's the story of a young American woman, actually an Irish-Italian woman, 20 years old, as American as they come, and she has fallen in love with sushi, as have many of us. And she has fallen in love with it so much that she decided that she wanted to become a sushi chef. And I ran into her at the California Sushi Academy, where I went to do some research, and I ended up following her through her training to become a sushi chef. And it's a great story because she had no cooking experience at all. She had no knowledge of Asia or Japan. She just went into it with faith and struggled, you know, to get through this training, which was really grueling. The instructors were like samurai. And along the way, through her story, you learn the history of sushi, how it evolved in Asia and Japan, where it comes from. It's a lot of really fascinating things about the meal that I just had no idea about.
Well, by following along with her education, we are in turn educated, and I found that an interesting way to write. Okay. Why did you decide to write it through her eyes?
Well, I showed up. Basically, I decided I wanted to write a book about sushi, and then the challenge was figuring out how to tell an American story about sushi, because I write for an American audience, and I wanted to make sure that my readers would be able to relate to it and not just have the story kind of disappear into sort of a trip to Japan, you know, completely foreign land. And that's when I found this California Sushi Academy, which was a very interesting place. I just heard about it, and I flew out to L.A. and checked it out. And it had been opened in 1998 by a Japanese chef who was worried that demand for sushi in the U.S. was outstripping the supply of trained chefs, because in Japan it takes like 5 years of an apprenticeship to become a sushi chef. And he was concerned there might be health implications and that sort of thing. So he set up this academy to train chefs more quickly. And it's controversial and it's unorthodox, you know, but he felt that it was important to take this approach because Americans were embracing sushi. So I went there, and there were about 8 students who made it through that semester that I covered. I spent about 3 months hanging out at this academy every day. And Kate was one of those students, and I didn't know which student I was going to focus on. But ultimately, I chose her just because I felt that even though she wasn't, you know, she didn't have the best sushi chops, but I felt that she would be a character that would be easy for people to relate to, and it would be a good way to kind of bring people along into the story of this complex cuisine. And she also, you know, went through a kind of a transformation. She started out without much self-confidence and really, you know, made her way through this, and I was inspired by her story. And she's now working as a female sushi chef.
Well, she definitely had a story to tell.
In Japan, if you want to be a sushi chef, that's a 5-year apprenticeship, and it's not really. There aren't a lot of female sushi chefs in Japan, is my understanding. Isn't that correct?
Right, yeah, that was interesting to learn about the gender discrimination. I write about this in the book. There are all kinds of excuses that male sushi chefs use to try to defend their territory against female sushi.
Some of them are kind of funny. We share. It's pathetic, but funny.
Kind of funny and almost all of them completely bogus. The biggest reason that's often given is that supposedly women have warmer hands than men, and so the idea is, they're going to cook the fish by handling it with their hands. And I cite some scientific studies that prove that that's just backwards.
You know what I think is funny?
The exact opposite.
What I think is funny is that you actually had to disprove that. To my mind, and maybe it's a very Western mind, but to my mind, I can do a little like, oh, come on. You know, and that's enough. I don't need to really justify
Yeah, and you think about, you know, how many couples argue over the man being too
cold-handed.
The guy's always too cold and the woman's always too hot. Or no, it's the vice versa.
Yeah. Right, it's the opposite.
The guy's always too hot. And so everybody's fighting over the thermostat all the time. But then there's like, perfume and body lotion and makeup. And well, you don't have to use any of those things if you're a sushi chef. And then there's like more esoteric stuff. Some of these sushi chefs say women don't have the spirit or the reflexes or the skills, you know, to
What kind of reflexes do you need? The fish is dead.
No, it's not running away from you.
I mean, a fisherman, maybe, I guess that argument might hold a little water. Hey, listen, Trevor, we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back. I want to talk more about sushi feminism with you in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Trevor Corson about his new book, The Zen of Fish.
Trevor, for years, I have been dipping the rice side of my sushi in this soy wasabi mixture that I've seen so many other people make before they eat their sushi. Why didn't anybody tell me I was doing it wrong?
Well, none of us knew. I didn't know either. In fact, yeah, on my website, thezenoffish.com, I've got this page called How to Eat Sushi, and it's sort of, it's got pictures, and I summarize all the things I learned about the proper way to eat sushi, which I didn't know either. And yeah, most of us do everything wrong. And it's not, the point isn't that, you know, this is some sort of etiquette thing, like you have to abide by Japanese tradition. It's more that we're not getting the full potential out of our sushi because of the way we eat it. And there's a couple of examples of that I can give you. For example, you mentioned dipping the rice side of the nigiri, those little packs of rice with a slice of fish on top called nigiri, dipping the rice side in the soy sauce. Well, the problem is, for starters, that when you do that, the chef has got to now pack those rice balls pretty tight so that it doesn't fall apart in the soy sauce. And that immediately right there kind of defeats the purpose of nigiri, which is those little packs of rice are supposed to be quite loose so that when you put it in your mouth,
they just kind of fall
apart. Mm-hmm. You get this wonderful sensation of these individual grains of rice mingling with the fish, and it becomes this mixture rather than what most of us, you know, when we eat sushi, the chefs are adjusting to our eating techniques, so they're packing it tightly. So it's like, you know, you're gnawing through this chewy, hard pack of rice, which isn't at all what it's about. And Japanese people would refuse to eat sushi that was made that way, which is what many of the Japanese chefs told me. And they actually did an MRI scan of that I talk about in the book of the sushi made by the best chefs, and it's full of empty space and air. So that's just one example. Another,
you just said they did an MRI scan of the sushi.
I said they did an MRI scan.
Okay, I want you to know something. A lot of people think that I have a problem, that I take my food too seriously. Come on now.
Isn't that great?
Well, the interesting thing in your book that I thought was great is you say if an American goes or if a non-Japanese person goes to a very good sushi bar where the chef is making the rice properly loose and he sees that American or non-Japanese person dip their sushi rice side first into the sauce, he'll then adjust the way he makes the sushi to make it wrong so that you can eat it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And there was one of the most famous sushi chefs in Japan said, you know, I quote him saying, as soon as he sees a Westerner walk into the sushi bar, he immediately starts making the nigiri so hard that no Japanese person would eat them because he knows that the Westerner doesn't know how to eat it, right? That's what he assumes.
I think that John Belushi would have handled it much better as a samurai sushi guy. He would have just gone, hoyo! You know, and would have put a...
Well, and also, here's another tip. You can eat sushi with your fingers. Sushi aficionados tend to eat it with their fingers. They don't use chopsticks because that, again, if you try to pick up a nigiri with chopsticks, it has to be packed hard so it won't fall apart. If you're using your fingers, you can... It can be much more delicate because you can handle it just long enough to get it in your mouth before it falls apart.
So the fork thing is all wrong then.
Whoa! Whoa!
What sushi restaurant?
Well, and the other thing is, you talk about, you know, when you dip it in, you eat the sushi upside down. Fish should hit your tongue first, not rice.
Well, yeah, that varies. I mean, it's, so that's sort of open to preference.
Actually, we're going to leave that as a cliffhanger and come back with more advice on sushi after the news. If you're listening to The Restaurant Guys, our guest is Trevor Corson. His book is The Zen of Fish. We'll talk to you in a minute. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hi again, Francis.
We're back. I have my tea. Our guest today is Trevor Corson. He joins us to talk about his new book, The Zen of Fish. His first book was The Secret Life of Lobsters, and we're talking about sushi.
You know, Trevor, we were talking before the break about, you know, the mistakes that we sometimes make when we're eating sushi, and I think a lot of us are intimidated when we walk into a sushi bar. You know, I for years took those little squares and ate them in two bites.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, we all kind of lack this knowledge, and part of the thing I'm trying to do with the book is you know, as you read through the story, just I'm trying to arm people with the basic set of knowledge so that they'll feel comfortable walking into the sushi bar, and they'll have a whole background of knowledge to draw on now, and also with, you know, the kind of how to eat sushi tips on my website, thezenoffish.com, it's exactly that. I want to give people a little arsenal of facts so they can feel comfortable with that experience at the sushi bar, because yes, it's intimidating, but to my mind, it's also what makes sushi so worthwhile.
It's also fascinating at the same time.
Yeah, it's about that social experience of interaction with the chef, you know, and not just the food.
But especially me, I have such a big mouth, there's no reason for me to eat that in two bites. There really isn't.
I was thinking that.
Well, you know, another thing that's happened is that as sushi has become Americanized, of course, we love big portions, so sushi chefs follow right along and make us huge portions to indicate that, you know, they're a generous restaurant, but that's not really doing any of us any favors. It's nicer to have smaller nigiri that we can just pop in our mouth in one bite.
Well, it's better to have larger portions of fish than chicken McNuggets, you know what I mean? That's better for you.
True.
But the question is, how do portions line up here as opposed to in Japan? Are the portions a lot larger, the portions of the individual pieces of fish?
Well, I just think it varies from place to place, and it depends how conscientious the sushi chef is and how much they're paying attention to their customers and how much they've just sort of given up on Americans. And a lot of sushi chefs are going to have to be kind of coaxed back into paying attention to us as serious customers. But the chefs I talked to in L.A., you know, the experienced ones really made a point of saying to me, and I described this in the book, teaching the students that a sushi chef's job involves sizing up each customer, you know, literally and metaphorically, and figuring out how to adjust the sushi to each customer's needs, whether the person has a big mouth or a small mouth, or whether, you know, what kind of mood they're in, what kind of, are they there to drink and eat a little sushi, are they there to fill up, you know, a big lunch or what? And so they'll adjust the size of the sushi and the way they make it accordingly.
In that way, I think the sushi chef is very much like a bartender. They're supposed to be interacting
exactly,
with the customer.
Exactly. So there's really no reason to be that intimidated about going to a sushi bar, because the chef expects, I mean, basically, the idea is that the chef expects to interact with you.
Ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think an interesting thing you deal with in your book, a lot of folks are intimidated to go and sit at the sushi bar. Americans are intimidated to go in sushi bars because we feel that, and so we'll sit at a table and order off a menu, which is sort of a less
it kind of defeats the purpose, yeah.
Well, but you point out that we have this notion, I think, that, you know, all Japanese people are very comfortable walking in, plopping themselves down at the sushi bar and very acquainted with the rites and rituals and manners of the sushi bar, but even Japanese people are sometimes intimidated by the sushi bar.
Well, yeah, that was really interesting for me was, you know, when I was living in Japan, I would only eat sushi when, you know, some wealthy friend who knew some really great, expensive, high-end hole-in-the-wall place would take me, and, you know, we'd have this incredible experience. And I'd mentioned that to one of my, you know, more regular Japanese friends, and their eyes would open wide and say, "Oh my God, I've never done that." You know, so it for a long time, sushi was this kind of high-end, exotic experience, even in Japan. And, it's now there's, people have probably heard of conveyor belt sushi, you know, mm-hmm. these kind of fast food sushi chains, where the sushi goes around on a conveyor belt, you just pick off what you want, and it's kind of become more democratized since then, and a lot more Japanese people are now eating sushi because of that, but you're exactly right. They have some of the same hang-ups and gaps in their knowledge of sushi eating that we do.
Well, now, let's talk about the difference between conveyor belt sushi and sushi made by, you know, Masa in New York City or a great sushi chef anywhere. You know, when we talk about the difference between the hamburger that was made by, you know, a human being, which is, you know, fresh ground beef, you know, made into a patty by hand, maybe grilled in a grill, it's all beef, as opposed to what is a fast food burger, which is, some burger-like thin substance that's been frozen for a long time. And you know, the difference between fast food and real food when you talk about hamburgers is huge. What's the difference between conveyor belt sushi and sushi by a great sushi chef?
Yeah, it's really interesting because sushi is kind of in between those extremes. Like, the cheaper sushi hasn't really become fully, you know, industrialized the way, say, a McDonald's hamburger has. So it's still a closer connection with the origin of the food.
Right, it's a piece of fish still.
Yeah, it's still a piece of fish, exactly. But at the same time, you know, there's this whole huge industry that's sprung up to supply these fish, and a lot of them, we don't really think about this, but I talk about it in the book, that we sort of assume sushi's all fresh, you know, probably wild-caught fish and stuff. A lot of this fish is now being mass-produced for sushi and aquaculture operations, and a lot of that fish is specifically, what we like about it in sushi is specifically a result of aquaculture, because they can fatten these fish up, whether it's, you know, yellowtail is a great example. Everybody loves yellowtail. It's so succulent and rich and everything. Well, that's because all the yellowtail you're getting in sushi anywhere, regardless of whether it's a low-end place or a high-end place, almost all those fish are all coming from one little cluster of yellowtail farms in western Japan, and they gorge these fish on huge amounts of feed to fatten them up. They get much fatter than they would in the wild. So it's almost like we've created, you know, these Frankenstein fish that fit this ideal of the succulence that we now crave in sushi. And it's interesting, that's not even traditionally what was valued in sushi. Traditionally in Japan, you know, decades ago, what was really valued in the high-end sushi places were these leaner fish like flounders and snappers and stuff.
Well, first of all, I was going to say the wild fish, when you taste a wild fish next to a farm-raised fish, it has so much more depth of flavor.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no question about it. But, well, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is what we're looking for a lot, or a lot of certainly Americans are looking for in their sushi, is not necessarily depth of flavor.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think we've got this cult of, I'd call it like the Toro cult, you know, the cult of these fatty cuts of fish that melt in your mouth, and it's a lovely sensation to be sure. But yeah, we're actually missing out on a lot of flavor, the flavor that comes when a fish gets exercise and eats natural prey and that kind of thing. But we're also missing out on texture, and this was really interesting to me reading some Japanese material, some Japanese books about sushi, to discover that the textures of these fish are highly valued traditionally in sushi. So that when you put a piece of, for example, the adductor muscle of a flounder is a delicacy in Japan. It's called engawa in Japanese. It's a very chewy piece of fish. It doesn't melt in your mouth at all.
But it's meant
sushi
to
connoisseurs
be.
Considered that, you know, mm-hmm. one of the high points of traditional sushi.
Let's go from high points to other points. Talk to me of spicy tuna rolls.
Spicy tuna was this great invention that the sushi chefs in L.A. discovered in the late 70s because they realized with you know, the Mexican influence in the Southern California, people love spicy food, they realized they could take the garbage cuts of tuna, you know, stuff that had started to turn, or, you know, the fibrous scraps near the tail that they couldn't serve as sushi. They could take that, chop it all up, mix in a whole bunch of chili sauce, and then serve that in a roll, and Americans loved it.
I'll tell you, I'm not so worried about the fibrous parts by the tail. I'm much more worried about the stuff that started to turn.
So in Japan...
Much bigger concern.
In Japan, no such thing as spicy tuna rolls?
There's a lot of sushi in America that we take for granted that has been mostly unheard of in Japan. For example, inside-out rolls, you know, the rolls that we are all eating in sushi, these California rolls and everything, never existed in Japan. They're now being re-imported to Japan as American-style sushi.
That's funny. So what I want to caution everyone is that the spicy tuna roll was invented in the ancient Japanese city of Los Angeles.
Yeah, right.
It's a very, very frightening prospect. We'll be back in just a moment talking more about sushi and the history of sushi and some things you can do to better arm yourself and to go to a sushi bar in just a moment with Trevor Corson, author of The Zen of Fish. Central Jersey, 1450, time is 1145.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Francis and Mark, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Trevor Corson. He's the author of The Zen of Fish, the story of sushi from samurai to supermarket. You can find out more about it and even pick it up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. His other book is called The Secret Life of Lobsters, which was a cool show we did. You can find that out. Also, you can listen to the other show on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Sushi is amazing, and I think a little intimidating to Americans. And I remember, you know, being in my 40s, that 20 years ago, the majority of the American population was like, ew, raw fish. I'm not having that. And now, you know, you can get it at the sushi counter at the Wegmans or the supermarket you're in, and you pick it up on the way home, don't think anything of it.
Now I can serve rare scallops, and people are like, hey, you overcooked this.
Yeah, exactly. It's changed. Now, tell us, though, and one of the fascinating parts of your book, because you are a great journalist and you really do have an exhaustive look at things in the work that you do, tell us about the history of sushi in Japan and how it originated and how it's really gone through a great metamorphosis to become what we now know either in Japan or the West as sushi.
You got 45 seconds. Go ahead.
45 seconds.
I'm sorry. Just go ahead.
That's broadcast journalism.
Well, readers will just pick up the book to get the full story. But the really interesting thing was it started out completely opposite of what it is now, which was that it was a way to not to have fresh fish, but to preserve old fish.
Now, how did that work?
It started out not near the ocean, where you could have a regular supply of fresh fish. It started inland in northern Indochina, which is basically like or northern Thailand now. And these people who lived on the rivers had seasonal supplies of fish that came and went. So they wanted a way to preserve their fish. So they realized they could pack the fish in cooked rice. The cooked rice would rot and create acids that would then help protect the fish inside.
So, and how did that rice taste after a few months packed on the fish?
You do not want to eat that. They would dig this up and scrape off all the disgusting smelling rice, and then the fish inside would have fermented, but it would still be edible. It was kind of like a stinky cheese, and you know, but perfectly edible. And
stinky cheese fish sounds delicious, Trevor. I can't wait.
You know, I've actually eaten this. It's not bad.
Is it really good?
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, you know, it's unusual, but I quite enjoyed it.
I want to point out, Trevor, that Francis said, "Is it really good?" twice, and twice you said, "It's not bad."
Yeah. So,
well, it doesn't show up on many restaurants, but there's a place you could still get it in Japan, near the old capital city of Kyoto, and they make it with carp, basically relatives of goldfish.
Yummy.
Anyway, yummy. No.
So let's talk about what now how that evolved.
Yeah, what happened was this method of preserving fish spread through China and then over to Japan, and we think maybe because Genghis Khan and the Mongols invaded, and they were big meat eaters. They weren't interested in preserving fish. But in Japan, it caught on. And what happened was people started to eat it sooner and sooner in this fermentation process, and they discovered that, you know, relatively soon in the process, before the rice actually went bad, it developed kind of an acidic tang. It had a nice sour taste to it, so people started eating the rice along with the fish. And now this has become completely reversed. When rice vinegar was invented, people would just use freshly cooked rice, splash in a little rice vinegar, which would have that same acidic tang to it, and put fresh fish on top. And now sushi, the word sushi actually doesn't refer to raw fish at all. It refers now to the rice that's flavored with vinegar and some sugar and salt. And that's what defines sushi. And this became very popular in 1800s in old Tokyo as a fast food. It was basically the McDonald's drive-thru of old Tokyo.
Well, you know, I love the history and all that stuff, but I got to tell you, one of the things that I think that the book shows that is pleasurable to a lot of people who are reading it is you get to debunk all those scary things about being at that counter in front of that sushi chef. And so many sushi people who go to these places are afraid that they're doing it wrong. Now, I like to go to a place and I like to say, make me dinner.
Yeah.
What should you do if you're going to a sushi bar and you want them to just make you dinner?
Yeah. Yeah. That is absolutely the best way to do it. I mean, what this experience is about is basically sort of trusting the chef to recommend what he's got that's going to be most interesting for you to eat. And this takes time. You've got to develop a relationship with a chef over time. So first of all, people always ask me, where do you go to get the best sushi? And you know, the answer to that really is just shop around a little bit till you find a chef whose company you enjoy and who you like talking with, and then just keep coming back there, get to know them. And after a while, they'll start realizing you're serious and you're a regular, and they'll start to suggest things for you, and you'll say, yes, I'm open to this or I'm not open to that. And that's where, you know, the make me dinner experience really gets interesting.
Now, along the lines of the make me dinner experience, there are three ways to order sushi at a sushi bar. Can you tell us about them?
Well, yeah, in Japan, basically, somebody goes into a sushi bar and they say one of three things. And one of them is okimari, which means give me a sample plate, and another is okonomi, which means I'm going to tell you which fish I want to eat one by one. I'm just going to sort of think about it and eat what I want. And then there's omakase, which some Americans have heard that term, which means, all right, chef, show me what you've got. You know, give me your best run. Give me an incredible exotic experience, one morsel at a time. And you know, that method can get pricey pretty quickly. So I also recommend an intermediate thing, which is more along the lines of make me dinner. You can go into a chef and sort of just chat with them and have some back and forth and ask, you know, what they would recommend based on your preferences. And you can also, if you want, you can give them a budget. You can say, look, I want to spend about $30 tonight. You know, what would you recommend? That's okay.
Now that's not considered rude.
No, I don't think so. What's rude is to order omakase and then quibble over the price.
Well, when you order
omakase,
better
to set it in advance, because then there's no, you know, expectations at the end, because the sushi chef is really going to use his own judgment about how much he charges you based on what he serves you from his arsenal.
And when you order omakase, you don't necessarily get an itemized bill.
No, you don't. And you know, they'll, in fact, sushi chefs are famous. The good ones are famous for you know, memorizing everyone's bill in their head, and the sushi chefs I've talked to say that usually, if anything, the customer comes out ahead because if anything, they'll forget something.
I'm going to tell you that the tasting menu in most restaurants, I think the customer generally comes out ahead. That's the whole idea of it.
Well, because there's a certain amount of ego involved in your tasting menu, and you're like, listen, they're trusting me. I have to wow them. And I think that's true in Western restaurants. And as tasting menus become more and more prominent in American restaurants, and certainly the same is true in Japanese restaurants. Trevor, will you stay with us for one more segment?
Sure will.
We'll be back in just a moment with Trevor Corson. His book is The Zen of Fish. Find out about it. Buy it at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1155. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Francis and Mark, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Trevor Corson, author of The Zen of Fish. Trevor, you know, one of my favorite things in a sushi bar is that... Is that green blob of wasabi that I get, right? That's traditional, right? That's wasabi?
So it turns out, A, not only is it not wasabi, but B, it's not traditional.
So what is it?
But it is green.
It is green because of the food coloring. It is horseradish. All the wasabi we get in the U.S., you know, 99.9% of it, and most of the wasabi at lower-end sushi places in Japan is just horseradish that they've ground up and added green food coloring to. Sometimes they try to mix in a little real wasabi, but real wasabi is quite different. It's a very unique and rare plant, very hard to grow, incredibly expensive, difficult to work with, doesn't keep, all that stuff. But its taste is more interesting than the plain old horseradish. It's got some sweetness to it, a complexity of flavor, as well as the spiciness, and the spiciness isn't as strong. And either way, whether it's the horseradish or real wasabi, the chef puts a little dab of it inside the sushi when he makes it, and that is really the most wasabi that he wants you to have with that piece of sushi.
So when a great sushi chef hands me a wonderful piece of sushi and I take about a teaspoonful of that wasabi horseradish powder and mix it up in my soy sauce to make something that makes me sweat, and I dip my sushi in that, he gets mad, right?
Well, I'll tell you what he's thinking, and I know this because I sat around talking Japanese with a bunch of chefs, and they would tell me what they really think when this happens. Is they think, why do I bother getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to the fish market to choose the best fish? Because this person is not tasting this fish at
Can't
all.
Tell anyway.
They're tasting the wasabi.
Yeah.
I will also never forget. It was 1992. We opened our restaurant, and I went someplace. I borrowed wasabi powder from the Japanese restaurant in New Brunswick, and I learned that you can buy a 5-pound bag of wasabi powder for about $10.
Sadly, there's no wasabi in it. Hey, Trevor, thanks for joining us. It's been a pleasure. We've enjoyed having you. We'll put the book up on the website and send people to it.
Great. It's always fun talking with you guys.
Thanks
Trevor. For having me.
Likewise. Hey, and listen, if you want to get real wasabi, I know that if you go to Masa, which sadly is one of the most expensive restaurants in the country, at the Time Warner Center, I know that Chef Masa uses real wasabi and will make you a lunch for $200-$300. No problem at all. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the restaurant, guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.